left off about here. We've sort of gotten through these benchmarks of development. So we'll move on. This concept called Machiavellian intelligence. You may know who Machiavelli was. He was essentially a courtier in 16th century Italy, and he wrote this famous little book called The Prince. Basically, it's a political rule book on how you can gain ultimate power. One of the sort of little taglines that comes out of Machiavellianism is keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Rule with the iron fist and the velvet glove, these sorts of things. In other words, don't present your true face. It's okay to manipulate others as long as you win in the end. And there is an art form to political manipulation. Now, if you know anything about, 16th, 17th century Italian city-states, it was all about internal conflict, manipulation, backstabbing, front stabbing, lots and lots of stabbing, poisoning. You get the idea. So, this is where this comes from. But it's been taken, so if we talk now about Machiavellian politics, we're talking about situations even today where people are not really representing themselves accurately, or they present one face, they say one thing to one group, do something else with another. Now, this concept has been adapted into evolutionary psychology with respect to social cognition. When we exist in a social group, as humans do, a certain amount of deception and manipulation is going to be necessary. Think about it. How well are you going to be able to maintain, say, all of your friends if you don't occasionally tell a little white lie? I never lie. Sure you do. Autistics don't lie particularly well, or often, because it doesn't often occur to them that they really should. And how many friends do autistics have? Not usually that many. Why? They're hard to be around. Or, well, we'll talk about some other examples of this later. Regardless, deception and manipulation is something that humans are very good at. Even if we don't like to, I don't lie, sure you do. People have to really be able to exist in a sort of, you may not lie about the big things, but the little stuff, Do I look fat? Asks, girlfriend or boyfriend. What do you say to that? Yep. End of that relationship. Do you like my new haircut? Is this a good shirt? Do you think I'm smart? Are you going to do those dishes now? Yeah. Okay, so this is the idea, Machiavellian intelligence. But to be able to be good at this, you have to be able to understand not only your own intentions, but those of others. In other words, you require at least second-order intentionality, and frankly, to be good at it, you got to have more than that, really. You got to get into the higher orders. So to be able to excel and prosper, and think about this from the self-esteem perspective, right? You got an R value of 1 with you. To be able to have you be successful, sometimes you got to put you first. Really, I turned that assignment in on time. I can't understand why the office staff didn't get it into your mailbox until it was late. Oh, okay. Let's go. Machiavellian intelligence. Doesn't make you a bad person. It makes you good at the game of evolution, if you will. All right. Now, we'll be seeing Machiavellian intelligence come in again and again through the rest of this course. This is not always easy. There are all kinds of things that can make your ability to be successful with respect to Machiavellian intelligence difficult. We've got a range of cognitive forms. Talk about sort of your average normal into abnormal conditions. The way a schizophrenic approaches things, or an OCD individual approaches things, or an autistic individual approaches things, very, very different from how without these conditions does. We've got individuals that have gross morphological brain damage. that's going to change things enormously. But actually, generally, it's more the subtle changes that are the bigger obstacles. Cultural things as well. Right? There's different cultural practices as well that can mess people up. So very difficult to be a successful diplomat. There are historically so many examples of diplomacy gone completely awry, wars starting, simply because one individual misinterpreted what somebody from a different culture was trying to do, trying to represent. Okay? So these become very complicated issues. But again, keep in mind, back in the EEA, your ancestors probably exist in a group of maybe no more than 150, 200 people. Within, you know, that group was part of a larger territory of other, let's just call them tribal groups, that probably had some similarity to your own direct group. And so in terms of this cultural issue, you know, cultural differences, these were less extreme. You didn't go from your tribe 6,000 kilometers away and boom, get plunked down into the midst of another one where the cultural practices were completely different. You that grew up being exposed to the cultural practices, you were used to these. And that was probably much more of a constant than it is for people today. I mean, think about the number of international students that come to the University of Alberta. Coming from great distances, plunk, dropped into a totally different culture. And not just a general culture of Canada, but a different university culture. For example, North Americans' views on plagiarism are, to some extent, different from those in other cultures, where it may be in other cultures, it may be very acceptable just to cite and reference, or not actually, sorry, not cite and reference, but just take works from others as a sign of respect. But we call that plagiarism. I've had a few cases of that argument being made over the years. It doesn't work, but the deans don't like it, but it's probably an issue there. Okay. Now, as I said, it's often the subtle things that can really play Mary Heck with social cognition. And we're going to talk a little bit about issues of autism and autism spectrum disorder here. Autism affects about 0.05% of population of children, generally manifesting, or at least generally being detectable under sort of traditional diagnostic means after about the age of 2, 2.5. So we're getting this, we're getting this down lower, and that's good because the earlier one can make a possible diagnosis of autism, the earlier you can do intervention. Often behavioral intervention is still the best way to go with this. And the sooner that's begun, generally the greater chance you have of either minimizing or reversing the effects. Now, one of the things about autism that's been so complicated over the years is there's no obvious neurological damage. It's not like a big chunk of brain is missing. So the effects are quite subtle, but they're extremely far-reaching. Autism has impacts on language, cognitive processing, social impairment, specifically social cognition, and what we're interested here, theory of mind. Now, evolutionary psychologists that are interested in the evolution of cognition have actually devoted a lot of attention to autistics over the last 15 years because autistics have these theory of mind deficits, and that's what's so important in terms of social cognition for most of us. A quick comparison here on a false belief test will show that the issues that autistics have is not with general cognition, but really with the specific subset of cognition called social cognition. So take 4-year-old kids, normal and Down syndrome kids, and autistic kids. So our normal and Down syndrome kids by age 4, about 85%, 90% successfully pass the false belief test. And we talked about this last class. We put some crayons in a Smarty box, shake and ask what's in there, and see if the child can figure out what somebody else would think was in the box as well. Now, Down syndrome children have some severe deficits with general cognition. So the fact that they can pass this test with the same level of performance as normal children is saying that the problem here at the false belief test is not general cognition. It's not that they just don't get what they're being asked. It has to do with social cognition. And this is where the autistics fail. So the autistics do very poorly on this. High-functioning autistics can eventually learn to do this, but it's by using, a rule of thumb. It's sort of a rote. They don't really quite grasp why they're supposed to say, you know, Bob would think there's Smarties in the box when they clearly know that there's crayons. They don't really get it, but they get that the adult wants them to say that, so they go that way. So high-functioning autistics often can just fake it. Incidentally, we can also do what are called true belief tests, and autistics are generally fairly poor on that one. So what we're seeing here is for autistics, they've got these deficits in theory of mind. They've got, if you will, a lack of deep understanding of social situations, social cognition. Now, this and the impairments they have are very specific. Doesn't affect things like, for example, false photo memory tests. So this is linked into social cognitive deficits. So you can show an autistic child a bunch of pictures, let them study the pictures, come back the next day, toss some other photos in and say, you know, have you seen all these before? And they'll be able to pick out the ones that they haven't seen before. They're good at that. There's other things that they tend to show deficits on, behavioral deficits. Joint attention, either lacking or reduced at an early age. The poor at telling lies. That goes back to, if you're going to be able to tell lies, you have to be able to actually understand how someone else is thinking. No or limited pretend play. Don't really understand desire in others. They understand desire in themselves. So they got first order intentionality, but they often have problems. Now, keep in mind, I'm making some very broad generalizations here. One of the things with autism is it's a massively wide continuum. You've got individuals that are very low functioning, and it's like even if you've never been around autistics before, you look at the child or the adult, yeah, there's something wrong. There's something going on here. And then you've got the high functioning, going through this whole continuum, but the high functioning, and it's just like, they're just a little bit odd, but yeah, they could be like, somebody off of, Big Bang, right? The show Big Bang, right? Sheldon, okay? It's like, autistic or physics professor, hard to say, right? Okay, so there's your high functioning. You might go, this is a Star Trek fan, I don't know. Okay, so, this is the thing with autism. It's a huge range. And this has led individuals to suspect that it's not just a simple, single kind of function. It is a genetic abnormality. It is the most heritable disorder that we know about in terms of this. Vaccines, nothing to do with this at all. Okay. But I gotta be careful. There's probably the odd individual that has some genetic predisposition where towards a reaction towards a vaccine, but it's probably stunningly rare. Just like you can have, you could have someone who, through a genetic predisposition, is allergic to their own skin. Again, it's stunningly rare in that case. Autism is caused by genetic effects, not the environmental effects there. So it's highly, highly, highly heritable. That being said, changing the environment may lead to an improvement. Okay, but the change in the environmental change is not issues of vaccination or power lines or things like that. The issue is social interaction and forced social interaction, really. Yeah?
If it's thought that autism is genetic, why...
Well, heritable, yeah.
Or heritable. Why have we seen such an increase in it over the past...
That's a good question. diagnostics is one issue. You go back not that long ago, and there simply was no diagnosis for it, right? The way we deal with, for lack of a better term, the mentally ill, individuals that have psychological disorders or differences, has changed markedly over the last century. Before this, you'd either abandon the child, stick them in an orphanage, and by abandon, take them out into the woods and just let them die. We'll talk about this later, but from an evolutionary perspective, you've got a child that's going to require constant adult care, even once they become an adult? Think about this from a differential reproductive perspective. Is this a good investment? Whereas you've got three other children who, so, I mean, abandonment, adoption, maybe into orphanages more recently, locked up in the attic. I mean, I'm not doing that in a job. Maybe just out of sight, you know. So many, I mean, you know, crazy uncles that you just sort of have to mind, and you have the staff take care of them if you're rich enough to have staff to do that. So we've taken, it's a massively different approach to psychological disorders. I mean, in fact, in the past, generally, you didn't admit them. Really, I mean, think about this from your prospects. you've got children that you're looking to marry, get married off so you can have grandchildren. And do you want the other people in the area to know you've got a string of crazy relatives? Does that make you a good prospect for marriage? Maybe not. Out of sight, out of mind, hide it. Again, self-interest for inclusive fitness. So there's that. We're much more open about dealing with mental illness now than we were in the past. Diagnostically, again, as well, there's issues here. Going in the past, I mean, our death rate of children was just higher, even through a good chunk of the 20th century, right? So we've got children surviving that wouldn't have otherwise. If you've got, here's another thing, a little bit harsh, but we know from a whole range of studies that parents, adults, will interact more with interactive children. Autistic children, not especially interactive. Now, I'm not saying that that's going to mean that adults around are necessarily going to ignore the autistic child, but they may get less attention. If they're getting a little less attention, you know, maybe the parent doesn't notice when they first start coming down with some sort of disease that now, actually, we can now vaccinate for, and they die. So there's all kinds of things going on, but I mean, even until you have something diagnosed, you can't really categorize it. You know, the 20th century is really the century of, especially mid to later 20th century, is the century of diagnoses. So there's certainly that. With all kinds of mental illnesses, or cognitive disorders and whatnot, even in the past, as long as you were able to like push a broom or a mop, you could probably find some sort of job. Right? We're in a very technologically driven society. There are fewer and fewer jobs that require really no skills to do. So these individuals stand out more. They end up on the streets. It's a massive issue for society. It's something that psychologists, people have a psychology background, need to be thinking about in terms of politics and voting and putting pressure on governments and social programs. What do we do about this? Right? Yeah, there's certainly that. So that's generally the feeling. I mean, I'm not saying that there. Well, here's another one as well, especially in the West, as we have more and more situations of either two parents in a family heading off and working, or single parent families where the parent has to work, so what happens to the child? Child ends up in probably some form of daycare, day home, whatever. Now, again, one of the issues, I'm veering off a massive tangent on this one, right? But I mean, treating autism is difficult. The techniques that have been developed since the late 1950s and 60s, which are massive amounts of behavioral intervention and involvement, behavior modification, working with focusing on joint attention, language skills, all of this is still about the most effective treatments that we've got. There's no magic drug that can just make autism go away. But if you've got an increasing number of families in the West that do not have parents necessarily having close interaction with the children at all times, then that's probably reduced. So there's probably some cases of children that do have a predisposition towards, you know, moderate to high functional autism, that if there had been more parental involvement with the child, perhaps in an earlier decade, that parent might have served as essentially a behavior modifier without you know, doing this intentionally, and at least move that child up to either, you know, from moderate to high functionality, or high functionality into apparently no deficits. So, you know, there's a whole range of explanations we can come up with. We don't have to postulate that something has changed radically in the environment right now. There are other, we do see interesting things in terms of environmental stressors, certainly. I mean, schizophrenia is one. Individuals moving from more rural kinship, tight kinship groups and coming into large urban centers, we do see that the incidence of schizophrenia in such immigrants is higher. Higher than average in the population, so there's really something, you know, there as well. But we don't have to postulate, you know, just a single vector like vaccines or power lines or whatnot. That's just correlational. Okay. Anyways, point of all this was to get back to theory of mind. So with respect, we talked about modules here. Now, again, part of the issue is people toss the term module around in a little bit of a loosey-goosey way here. So this isn't specifically meaning that these are completely impenetrable cognitive modules. But let's just broadly use module here. I mean, there's some chunk of brain tissues going around in your frontal cortex that do various things. So some evolutionary psychologists and other just clinical developmental psychologists have suggested that with autism, we may have a theory of mind module deficit. And this may involve, when we talk about primary problems, when we diagnose autism, we talk about the primary problems, which involve affective disorders. We talk about secondary problems, things like indifference to people, being literalists, these kinds of issues here. So this suggests that because we can categorize, we can sort of distinguish behaviorally between things, there may be more than one sort of neural system at work. These neural systems may have evolved to do different things. So this has come to be looked at as what's sometimes called a dual deficit system of theory of mind in autism. So there can be differences in, and here's the thing, because the argument is that while these different modules, there's perhaps at least two of them, possibly more, are working somewhat independently, but both contributing to theory of mind, part of perhaps the range of differences in autistics is due to relative differences in the effect. Perhaps one of these modules is pretty much completely functional, but one is not. You know, both being dysfunctional, or various levels. So this could lead to some of this continuum here. Now, looking at theory of mind here, we find that there's some interesting issues with autistics. One of the things they generally have a lot of problems with is what's called central coherence. So they have weak central coherence. This involves taking parts and organizing them into a whole. If you remember good old Gestalt psychology, right? Gestalt psychology, if a Gestalt psychologist made a t-shirt, it would say the whole is more than the sum of its parts. So if I took this coffee cup wouldn't work here, but if I took, you know, a coffee cup that has a mug that's got a handle on it or something like that, and I took a hammer, went bam, and smashed it into pieces and laid them out on the table, most of you would probably be able to reassemble it into something, go, ah, coffee mug. But if you've got problems with central coherence, it's like, I see a curvy bit, and I see a jaggedy bit, and I see a sort of bit that maybe came off the bottoms, the roundy bit. It's a bunch of bits. How did I do? Great, good job, well done. Okay, so they have difficulties focusing or taking the whole and bringing it together. This doesn't just manifest in smashed coffee mugs. It shows up in things like illusions, face recognition, these kind of embedded figures. You know, something hidden in there kind of pop out at you. Now, in some situations, this may actually be somewhat advantageous. I mean, I'm not suggesting that full-blown autism is advantageous, but, you know, at least perhaps having a bit of weak central coherence may allow you to focus very much on something. You get sort of pulled into something. You don't miss, you know, you miss the forest, but you know a lot about a tree. And in some situations, that might be great. If you're the tribe's, flint napper, you're making the arrowheads for the tribe. If you can just focus on making arrowheads, and not wondering, if I make enough arrowheads, will the girl over there like me more? Maybe I should make her a special arrowhead. And, your arrowhead consistency goes down and blah, 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 blah. If it's just like making arrowheads, great, Okay. But again, full-blown autistic or autism is probably not advantageous. So, as I said, I mentioned it was one of the most heritable disorders we know anything about here. There's some interesting stuff. Turns out, studies show that fathers of autistics, not autistic themselves, so the fathers aren't autistic themselves, but they're actually better at what we call piecemeal local processing tasks. In other words, the fathers have a certain amount of weak central coherence, too. Not to the level of say, their autistic sons or daughters, but they have a degree of this. Again, they kind of miss the big stuff, focus in on the small stuff. Now, that's suggesting, then, that we've got some sort of genetic involvement in this, some sort of genes that are involved in selecting for focusing attention, which undoubtedly we do, in fact, have. Another interesting one here. Another study has shown that the close male relatives of autistics, like fathers or brothers, are more commonly found, more commonly than chance, than you would expect by chance, to be in careers like physics or engineering or mathematics. These very focused kinds of areas. Having a father who's a biomedical physicist, I can attest to this. Physicists focus a lot of reductionism. Let's take it down to the base element here. Okay, so, again, not suggesting that these other male relatives are autistic, but if you take these kinds of focusing in on the, reducing down to a focused element, and now, boom, bump that up a little bit, take it to a bit more of an extreme, you can see where we start heading towards autism. So, it's been suggested that autism is perhaps an extreme form. It's kind of a popular sort of layperson descriptor here, but, extreme form of the male brain. So, as we said, there's a continuum, in terms of the abilities here. And even if we think about normal people, there is a continuum in normal individuals' abilities. So, if we were to perhaps draw this out, all right, so there's some sort of Gaussian distribution there for male behaviors, okay, and there's going to be some sort of Gaussian distribution for female behaviors. All right, so we've got a continuum. Now, perhaps we've got some sort of threshold point here above this. Perhaps on this continuum, there's all kinds of different genes that are involved. So just imagine, it's more complicated than this. Just your imaginative abilities here to suggest that if we were, it's more complicated than this, right? But simple demonstration, as we start having more and more of these genes that makes you more and more of that extreme male, okay? They start adding up. At some point, here, not autistic, and bleh, you cross some sort of threshold level, and autistic. Okay? Now, I haven't drawn this particularly well, but we know that there's about four times as many male autistics as female. Now, if we have something like this, you can see that just based on the volume of the graph under here, we will have more males than females. Similarly, if you take this the other way, down to the extreme female brain, right? High empathy, very emotive, right? Okay, I mean, take a look. We're getting more women that are better at that side of things than than males. Now, obviously, it's not a simple just additive structure of number of genes that are involved. We've got polygenics, we've got environmental, we've got all kinds of, but just in terms of a visualization, think, you know, I hope you visualize this here. So having, you know, some of these traits may be very adaptive, but if you have too many of them, ever seen pictures of, like, you know, extreme male bodybuilders? I mean, these guys are huge, right? Modern ones make, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger look small, even when he was at his peak. Ronnie Coleman, these sorts of things. Go to the supermarket and, like, check out the bodybuilding mags or something in the Safeway magazine rack. It's ripped, okay? Now, I don't have a picture with me right now, but I've shown these, sort of, you know, used this in courses in the past in evolutionary psychology of attractiveness, and women in the class, when I pop up like a picture of Robbie Coleman, go, "Gah!" It's like, good Lord, he's huge, but, yeah, right? I mean, his veins have pulsing veins, okay? So, you might say, we talked about like this shoulder-to-waist ratio, shoulder-to-hip ratio, and, I mean, these guys just aren't inverted pyramids or inverted triangles. They're like a complete Egyptian upside-down pyramid. I mean, they're massive. But they've gone beyond. So, I mean, having a certain amount of that makes the guy attractive. Going to an extreme makes it grotesque. Not really an adaptation there. Same sort of thing. Having a certain amount of these characteristics, adaptive, perhaps, for males. Beyond some level, not that useful. Now, as well, if we think about this in terms of, you know, the concept of folk physics versus folk psychology, right, again, sort of these lay public terms here, women are associated more with folk psychology, you know, better empathy, better with children, better listeners, males better at, you know, whether it's true or not, right, the idea of better at being building something or hunting something or, you know, whatever, and, you know, working with a tool or, you know, something. I'm not saying that's completely correct, but this is a stereotype. And stereotypes do have some sort of basis in reality, or they wouldn't be stereotypes, okay? So, we'll get these issues here. Now, recently, there's been a shift from just defining things as autism or Williams or Asperger's, and combining this into what's come to be called autism spectrum disorder, for better or worse. One of the other disorders that's moved in with the broader autism spectrum disorder is Williams syndrome. Now, we actually know an awful lot about the genetics of Williams syndrome, much more than we know about the genetics of autism. Bear in mind, there's probably about 100 genes that have been associated with autism. But there is no single autism gene. So you see in how we got a lot of interaction. There's probably still a lot more to go. With Williams syndrome, though, most of the genes that seem to be primarily involved reside on chromosome 7. Roughly 15 to 20 genes seem to be involved here. What happens with individuals with Williams syndrome is they tend to have lower IQ, so they've got some deficits in terms of general cognition, but they have some great language skills and musical ability. It's really quite interesting. Let me see if I can... where is this? Will this come up? Oh, we're still... Let's see if we can get up to this here.
Age and IQ matched Williams and Down syndrome children, not because they're alike, but because
So, a bit of Williamson. They're fascinating individuals. I mean, like I said, they're like this was showing here, their language abilities are actually really good. I didn't show you this, but musically, many Williamson individuals are spectacular musically. They seem to have an innate sense of rhythm, if you will. Some of them are amazing in terms of singing. You wouldn't expect this. They're also very, very sociable. They like being around other people. Autistics don't, usually. And it's not because autistics are hate people. Autistics generally, and again, there's a range, there's a continuum here, right? But I mean, generally speaking, autistics just don't care. If you don't have, if you're really lacking sort of your second-order intentionality there, it makes it really tough. If you got first order, I believe, I care, I think, but you're having problems with the second order, why do you really pay any attention to anyone else? So there's some issues, but Williamson do. They're very interesting people. You want to show someone with, you know, Williams syndrome a good time? Take them to West End and just let people watch. Just let them walk around. Interact with people. A blast. Okay. Great phrase processing skills too. Now the problem is, they tend to suffer from poor social judgment, and they have a lot of difficulties maintaining friendships with just people that don't know about the syndrome, and that's because they have similar sorts of problems as autistics with respect to false belief. They have these impairments. In other words, they're not good at Machiavellian intelligence. Williams syndrome individuals, for example, have a hard time lying. Now, let's imagine you've got somebody with Williams syndrome there, and they've had a friend who they haven't seen for a while, comes back after, you know, seeing him after 4 months, you know, maybe he's been away at, you know, over the summer at university, comes back, and, you know, their friend has put on a bunch of weight, and what's the Williams syndrome individual say? It's like, wow, you got fat! Now, they're not being mean. It's not like, ha, you got fat. Yeah. It's, you know, when their friend got a new shirt, it's nice to mention that. Wow, new shirt, really nice. Or new hair, you know, different haircut. You've changed your hair, I like it. Well, if you're changing appearances and people want that to be noticed, it's actually really tough to recognize that you shouldn't comment on some issues of changed appearance. Why is it that getting fat is something you shouldn't talk about, but changing your hairstyle is? That's weird. You have to actually have a deep understanding of not only how you think, but how somebody else thinks to get that. So this is why it can be difficult for Williams syndrome to maintain friendships with people that don't really understand. And again, before diagnosis and understanding of the parameters of the syndrome understood, this can make it really hard for family members too. Why do you say such hurtful things? They're not trying to be hurtful. They're just not lying, right? So we talked about this a little bit, Machiavellian intelligence, little white lies, right? Wow, you got, you look good. So, one possibility here is that we've got separate components with respect to the theory of mind system in the brain. Perhaps one is a social cognitive component which represents the mental states of others. And second could be a social perceptual component that represents the emotional states of others. Now, mental states, think of this as sort of, you know, the Mr. Spock logic understanding of things. Okay, so understanding thought processes and details and whatnot, with a social perceptual being the emotional. So what do those details actually mean? How does that translate into an emotional condition? Tager, Flusberg, and Sullivan have suggested that autistics have impairment in both components, whereas Williams syndrome have less impairment on the social perceptual system. So they want to make other people happy. They know that other people have emotions. They have emotions. Other people have emotions. They know when people are sad. They know when people are happy. They want to make their friends and other people around them happy. But they have a hard time understanding how others actually sort of process the thoughts. So the getting fat thing, it's like, I want to make them happy by noticing this change. But they can't grasp why, from sort of a broader cultural significance level, our culture may see that as a bad thing. Okay. Now, again, obviously, with these ideas, there could be different degrees of impairment in both of these separate components, right? So that could explain some of the differences along the continuum here. All right, so to sort of wrap this up with respect to modules. Most psychologists in the 21st century generally accept the Foderian concept of perceptual modules, right? That these are fast, impenetrable neural networks that are designed to deal with specific perceptual problems. That's generally pretty well accepted. We've got good neurological evidence for the existence of at least some of these, and postulating in other cases seems to make sense. Most evolutionary psychologists strongly favor the existence of at least some higher cognitive modules. There is, however, a great deal of debate as to how impenetrable these cognitive modules should be seen to be. There's also a good deal of a debate amongst people that describe themselves as evolutionary psychologists as to how many cognitive modules there might be, and the role of the issues with respect to general pattern classification. We have strong evidence for general domain systems. Years and years of cognitive science, cognitive psychology as well, for that matter, show that we are very, very good at general pattern classification. And it's very hard to fit that within a strictly impenetrable cognitive module system here. So there's a lot of debate about this currently going on. The Santa Barbara School, so followers of the Santa Barbara School, Cosmides and Tubies, tend to traditionally go more for, there are more of these cognitive modules. They are probably fairly impenetrable. And consequently, since they sort of hit the ground running first and sent out a bunch of their students, we get this a lot in evolutionary psychology. But people coming in from different backgrounds take a somewhat perhaps different view. There may also be an issue here that by making at least this postulation, this suggestion of higher cognitive modules that are impenetrable, it's actually something that's relatively straightforward in terms of testing, hypothesis testing, and theory testing in terms of this. Take an extreme position, and it's much easier to test that than taking some sort of moderate position. So if you're developing a new field of psychology, a theoretical sort of umbrella field for it, sometimes, at least in the start, postulating a somewhat extreme version of things may allow the theory to be pushed forward more rapidly. All right, let's finish up with that chapter. Now, we're going to skip forwards here, and we're going to pop up to chapter 9 in the text. kind of an odd sequencing in the books. I'm not quite sure why they didn't stick these together, but I think they fit a bit better together than going straight into 6, 7, or 8. So, evolution of cognition. All right, a few points to remember here. There are costs and benefits to any evolved system. Bipedalism and childbirth, for example. We've looked at that already. Bipedalism has certain advantages, or had certain advantages for our ancestors, but there's a cost in terms of problems with childbirth, and then the necessity of evolving essentially a premature birth compared to other non-human primates. You've got to remember, evolution does not optimize systems. Evolution only produces systems that are right, just good enough. They don't have to be perfect. How many people have corrected vision? Okay? It's not perfect. If it was perfect, none of us would have corrected vision. None of us would have sore joints. or lower back, and you're all young. You probably don't have lower back pain, right? You may not even have problems with joints. Okay, I need to go get a cortisol shot into my shoulder here to keep it from clicking, right? And calcium deposits building up. But hey, I'm old. I probably should have been eaten by a saber-toothed tiger by now or something like that. Or not moving far from camp and just like watching the kids. Hey, you kids, get off the dead zebra carcass. You know, that sort of thing. All right. So, just has to be good enough to make you last long enough to have some differential reproductive success. Overall, benefit to inclusive fitness. I can still see you, even with my other glasses there. You're slightly better, you know, right? It's okay. I mean, is it perfect? No. Is it good enough for survival? Yeah, probably. I said it gets worse with age. But then the older you get, the more likely you are just to die. So, yeah, easy peasy. Okay. There are costs involved in the massive amount of central nervous system that we have. And it is a stunningly high amount of CNS compared to our body size. Almost obscenely high, right? You might go, whales have more CNS. Yes, and whales weigh 5 tons. Compared to us, their brains are like walnuts, right? Compared to their body size. Now, I mean, this is a bit of a kind of crappy comparison because there's huge differences in terms of the environment that humans live in and whales live in. Okay, if we'd evolved to head into the, go back to the oceans, you know, turn into mer people or something like that, which would be a heck of a difficult evolutionary process, but not an impossible one, given enough time. I mean, whales used to be like giant wolves, right? Whales came from things that looked like really big, freaking scary wolves. I mean, picture a scary wolf, make it scarier, and make it the size of, say, a VW van, and that's what the precursor was of wolves. You think they hunted along shores? Their ancestors periodically would wade out into the shore, maybe ambush attack giant fish that would come in near to shore, or other things, like crocodiles or whatnot. You got something that's like eating crocodiles. That gives you an idea of how scary these things were, okay? And eventually, it just evolved, spent more and more and more time in water, kind of got flippery, anyways, da 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 da. And give it 50 million years, sure. You too can evolve, your ancestors can evolve into merfolk. Regardless, okay, we got big, big brains. I like big brains and I cannot, okay, anyways. Energetically, very expensive. I know, my jokes are terrible, okay? They seem funny to me at the time, but whatever. Very energetically expensive. About 20% of our energy budget goes into our heads. Now, when you consider that your liver is bigger than your brain, your liver's getting shortchanged here, right? I mean, just in energy. Your liver should be screaming, I am bigger than your brain. There you go. Why do we sink this much energy into our brain? Right, we've got all these downsides. We've got a risk of damage to our central nervous system. Right, I mean, it's pretty easy to smack this around. Concussions. Anyone been concussed? None of you? Wow, you guys don't get out much, do you? Huh. Most people in university, I mean, they're going hard and they're... Never mind, not important. Okay, so... things have changed since I was an undergrad. Okay, anyhow, yeah. Birthing complications we've talked about. There's these downsides. So if we've got all these costs, you got to say, there's got to be some sort of benefit from an evolutionary perspective. You know, what's the benefit here? What's the justification? How can we actually justify this? What makes it adaptive? Well, look at that. We've kind of got to step back and say, what's the brain do? Well, I guess the simplest approach here, the brain is just a biological computer. It is a computational device, a neuronal computational device. Has mechanisms that have evolved to deal with various environmental challenges, either through specific modules or through a general cognitive system. This leads into what has become called the computational theory of mind. And in fact, with better and better computers developing through the 1980s, 1990s, this led into some very interesting new forms of computer modeling of brain functionality. One of the interesting things here is various brain systems using, for For example, things that are called adaptive neural networks. These are computer programs that you don't specifically program. You sort of set it up as if it were an imaginary nervous system, and then you have to actually teach it to do things, which makes it really impractical for developing a, say, a word processor, right? You just want a word processor. You hard program that. It makes it very interesting for doing certain types of problem judgment tasks. The point here is that as computing power, actual mechanical computing power got better, we started to be able to do these things on the desktop. So through the mid to late 1980s and 1990s, it's really starting to take off. This allowed the development of, as I said, hardware and software models of brain function. You can test these. What the various testing has shown is what tends to be called substrate neutrality. That is, the actual hardware, mostly, let's say, doesn't really matter. You can make a computer out of Tinker Toys. You can make a computer out of silicone. You can make a computer out of neurons. Generally speaking, the actual sort of computational algorithms that are being done can be implemented regardless of whether it's Tinker Toys or silicon or neurons. So that's the idea of substrate neutrality. Once you've got that, it means you can do a lot of very interesting theory testing and modeling this way. Now, there are various levels of explanation then in terms of the computational theory of mind here. First, we can approach this from just a computational theory level. And that asks, the question that, people that work at this sort of level are asking is, what problem was the brain evolved to actually solve? Or, more correct, what problems, what multiple things was the brain evolved to deal with? You can also talk about approaches from a representational algorithmic level. You might say, well, what abstract mental computations is the brain evolved to execute to meet its goal? In other words, what programs are running? You might also look at this from a hardware implementation perspective. That is, how does a physical brain actually work? Now, think about this. Our computational theory approach here is very sort of evolutionary psychology, dealing with problems that would have been adaptive for our brain to deal with. The representational algorithmic, now we get into things like cognitive psychology, cognitive science, computing science in terms of robotics and AIs. Hardware implementation, here's where we get into things like the neurosciences. Let's take a brain apart and see how it works, or let's go in and see what a neuron actually does, either in situ or in a petri dish. Okay, so different areas that are in psychology or related to psychology, again, approach these from different levels, just as we've seen before. We're talking about the various levels of explanation. So in this sense here, if you will, the computational theory sort of is close to our ultimate, levels of explanation. Representation and algorithm, these are getting into issues like, say, the proximate and ontogenetic kinds of levels here. Hardware is probably more that phylogenetic level. So what do the neurons actually do? How do they work? How do they connect? Neurotransmitters are involved. So again, we can map these onto Lorenz's four levels of explanation here as well. And again, they can all be working with the same question, but give very different answers, obviously, because they're approaching it from radically different directions. All right. So, we can bring then evolutionary theory, evolutionary psychology, into this field of cognitive science. A lot of this has been done with things like visual perception, memory, and categorization and reasoning. These are some of the areas that have been predominantly looked at over the last 15 years. So we're going to take a look at, start by looking at visual perception here. Let's start and say, well, what's the visual system for? Simplest explanation here is the visual system just gives a representation of the external world. When I'm looking out and looking at all of you, you're the real world. That's not frightening at all. That's actually good. I feel good about that. You know, you're the real world. I have great hope for the future with my students. But I don't, in my brain, I don't actually have the real world. I have a representation of the real world. Now, when you look at either at me or around at others, your representation of the real world may be slightly different for mine. For example, if one of you were colorblind, your representation of the real world is going to be different than mine. Even if you're not colorblind, different people see colors in slightly different ways. Some of this may be experience, but probably a lot of it is just the actual formulation of each individual's specific retina, numbers of rods and cones, and other things in the structuring of their optical cortex. So there's going to be slight variations. Well, which is correct? Well, probably what's correct is when we get in a physicist in here, some sort of chromatometer that'll like give you specific wavelengths, spectral wavelengths of light bouncing off of all the different colors of your shirts and whatnot. But trying to translate that into something that actually seems like color the way you process it is very hard. The fact is, you really only have access to your internal representation. So, how accurate is this? Well, again, from an evolutionary perspective, it's accurate enough to allow you to survive long enough, hopefully, to be able to reproduce and pass on your genes. In many cases, actually, our visual system doesn't really represent the world as it is. Consider, in the early morning, sun at a low level, noon, sun straight overhead, afternoon, lower, setting into the west. Now, based then on the position of the sun, we're getting different degrees of refraction of the light and passing through the particles in the atmosphere. And what that means is it's actually going to change the color of, say, your shirt. If you've got somebody outside in a red shirt and you're looking at them in early morning versus at noon versus 4 o'clock in the afternoon, if you had a little device, they exist, where you could actually measure the wavelengths of light that were bouncing off that shirt at the different times of day, you would get different readings. I mean, not radically different readings, but there would be different readings. The color of the shirt would actually change. Can you imagine how messed up you would actually be if your brain didn't correct for this? In the morning, you see your friend wearing a red shirt. At noon, they're wearing a different red shirt. And in the afternoon, it's a different red shirt. How many shirts does your friend have? When does he have time to change? You may not even recognize it as your friend if, imagine it's not a shirt. Let's go back in time before we had shirts, right? Just the color of body hair or skin, right? Oh, hi, Bob. Oh, you're not Bob. Sorry, I am Bob. No, you're not. You're slightly darker in hue. I'm Bob. You must be a different Bob. No, I'm the same Bob. But you, however, I don't know because my friend Steve has a slightly blonder pelt. No, I am Steve. You must be a different Steve. When I saw this, see how messed up that is? Our brain just fixes that for us. It puts a filter, if you will, through this so that we don't actually see the world of completely changing colors as the day progresses. Just like, yeah, it's the same red. That's the same shirt. That's the same person. Okay? Now, the question is this a design flaw or an adaptation? Now, from an engineering perspective, physics perspective, it might be great to have the device that can actually measure the precise wavelengths of light that are bouncing off articles of clothing or skin or whatnot. But how useful is that really for us in day-to-day existence? And this is one of the very interesting things we get into in terms of evolution. If an engineer were to build a human, if they could, they would probably do it in a very different way. Non-evolved way, an optimized way. But each of those individual optimizations may lead to different problems. Right? So, design flaw or adaptation? Think about that as we take a look at some optical illusions. Now, one of the nice things about optical illusions is they're just fun, okay? But from a serious psychology perspective, they actually tell us a lot of things about how the brain sort of works here. They're showing that the internal representation is not actually the same as the external features of the world. So, that's a Hermann grid. See how I very carefully put those slightly gray dots in the intersections of each of the white lines? You see the sort of gray dots, right? there are no gray dots. It's messing with you. Yeah, okay, fine. You've probably seen this before, right? Not really there. Tells us something about how the brain actually is visually processing. The herring illusion. Not named after the fish, named after a guy called herring. Okay? So the bent red, the red lines are bent, right? Look a little bit bent. Not a lot. I mean, maybe a little bit. If people are going, no, they look totally flat, you're either lying to me or we need a piece of your brain to study. They should look a little bit bent. Take that away. They're parallel. Okay, so parallel red lines. You put the other lines going back into an infinite perspective point, and we get a little bent. Gone. Flat. Bent. Flat. Bent. Flat. Bent. Flat. I can do this all day. And that's when they had a seizure. I love this stuff. Julian Beaver's pavement art. Beaver's a pavement artist. Who knew you could actually make a living just drawing stuff on the ground? Most pavement artists can't. But Beaver has taken this and done some pretty cool psychological illusions here in terms of perspective. So this was from the Edinburgh G8 conference a few years back. So make proper history. So here's the globe, and here he is. He's standing on top of the globe, sweeping it up. Well, where they're standing right here, taking the picture, right, this looks like a nice round globe with Beaver being very, very small, standing on top of it. If you were to look at this from directly overhead, this is an extremely stretched out, elongated globe. It's a trick of perspective. Okay? He can't actually draw it round. He has to actually draw it in a way that will only look round like a globe if you're standing in just the right place. If you got one of these people standing over here looking at it sideways, it's just a big smear of colors. You've got to walk right over there to get that. Or over here, same deal. Tiny little, who knew that, you know, Justin Bieber's not just a little person, he's like a fairy. He's like this tiny, tiny little creature. Probably derived from those humans that were kind of the Philippines, the Hobbit humans, but even smaller. Right, so you know, by this it looks like we've got a normal-sized person here next to a giant bottle of beer or something, whatever it is, drink of some sort, offering Beaver a drink. Again, it's all about the perspective. You look at this over top here; it's a stretched-out bottle that only looks like a bottle with a ladder on it. If you're at exactly the right place, this is not new to Beaver. People have been doing this for hundreds of years in art. Pictures painted back in the 17th century, where you've got to stand at just, you look at it straight on, it's like, what the hell's this? Then you're like, oh, okay, I see, it's just like, whatever. And then it's like, but if you find the right location, you'll find some hidden skulls. Really? So you start walking around the picture, and like you get over like just on the side angle, and it's like, oh, look, there's a bunch of skulls in there. Ooh, profound statement about mortality and life. Oh. Very deep, very profound. You know, you can imagine that back in the 17th century, artists were doing the same thing, you know, trying to pitch their art. No, it's not just a bunch of scribbles on the page. It's actually, yeah, a profound statement about life. Just like artists kind of have to do today to get funding. Things have not changed at all over 400 years. The artists still have to kind of dress it up to catch people's attention. Anyways, again, illusions. Pretty cool, but the fact that your brain doesn't go, no, that's just a stretched out smear of color on the pavement. It's not really a round globe. Your brain isn't really representing it the way it is. Again, mistake or adaptation. Well, a suggestion here, perhaps best made by David Marr in 1982, is that yes, the visual system does not represent the world as it actually is. But this isn't a mistake. It is a specific adaptation. Because if your brain doesn't take and process this visual input into something useful, you're just going to be messed up. You will not be functional in the environment. Okay, think back to my rather bad drawing of a tiger behind a tree. Right? If your brain just says, oh, that's just the front part of a tiger with one leg, that's not dangerous. Matter of fact, I'm going to go get me a tiger head. Because them's good eating. I mean, you get eaten by the tiger. Right? If our brain doesn't actually take the world and turn it into something useful, those of our ancestors that were not able to do that got eaten. Going way back before we were even primates, right? Okay. Those of our distant ancestors, fish and stuff. They couldn't process the world in their tiny little fish-like brains. They didn't make it. Our brains have evolved to function in the real world. They have not evolved to function in some sort of abstract engineer's Platonic world of creation. Okay? Visual illusions mess with this. The reason, you know, in the sense that visual illusions work is because we're taking the real world and screwing with it a bit. The input that we get from these illusions, our brain interprets this, and it tries to turn it into something that is more beneficial to the viewer. It's based upon real-world issues. So the herring grid, right? Well, perspective. You see perspective like that in the real world. You stand someplace and you look at lines radiating away from you. Yeah, that's perspective. Things that are off in the distance are going to get smaller. You get that effect. The horizon has a curve to it. You're able to get out in the prairies or a desert or something and look away. So, curve. Okay, so perspective comes into this. We fill in. Our brain fills in missing pieces for it. It maintains the color consistency. It provides scale and perspective for us. And it does it all without us even knowing it's happening. Right? This is like the deep architecture of our brain. And again, it's suggesting this is very old. Right? This is not something that evolved with humans or even primates or even mammals. These are really old levels of brain processing. Okay, we do more with them. Brain processing as we go up gets better with larger mammals, and primates, and whatnot. But in terms of thinking of visual processing, the value here is that basically it's going to help you stay alive long enough to reproduce. Individuals that have problems with this probably don't last particularly long. Being blind is, back in the EEA, pretty much a death sentence. Unless you've got individuals that are willing to care for you. At that point, you got to be in a rich enough environment that people can manage to do this. You end a period like old classical. I think we know there were blind poets and musicians. The only reason, the only way they managed to survive was because they got really good at poetry and music. Being blind, they couldn't farm, they couldn't fight, couldn't do any of these other things. They had to find something to do that was of value to somebody else. But this only worked in an environment that was rich enough that had excess resources to spend on a poet or a musician. Visual processing, really, really important. Auditory processing, tactile processing, these are all important, okay? I'm just picking on visual processing today. Memory. Let's take a look at memory. Where's the value here? Past experience. Okay, memory allows us to use past experience to predict future events. If we think about classical and operant learning systems, right? Classical conditioning, you pair a a conditional stimulus with an unconditional stimulus, ring the bell, stick some food in the dog's mouth, dog salivates. Eventually, do this often enough, ring the bell, dog salivates. Conditional responses form. Well, the dog is predicting, oh, I hear the bell, food is coming, better start salivating now, get ready for it. Okay. Operant conditioning. In the past, when I do this, this outcome occurs. I should either do the same thing in the future or not. Again, you're making predictions about what's going to happen based upon past experience. keep that in mind. We're going to actually come back to that when we look look at issues in terms of child development and development or experience, child experience leading into adult behavior patterns. So keep this idea of learning as a means of making predictions about the future in mind here. So we can call this preparedness, if you will. Past experience prepares us for the future. You know what? You take a cognitive psychology course, you will go into so much detail about memory that you could probably choke a large ungulate with it. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to simplify this down enormously and probably insultingly to the whole field of cognitive psychology. But there we go. Episodic and semantic memory. There we go. Okay. I know. There's more to it. But just consider, in a very simplified form here, episodic specific memories versus semantic general facts. We've got different memory systems here. We can talk about memory as being inceptive and derived. Right? So inceptive being all the information that's stored at the time of an experience as opposed to derived, if you will, summaries of the experience. Now, think about this. What do you really need? How many details do you actually need? If you think back to this class tomorrow, will you remember all the specifics? Will you actually remember what every person in the class was really wearing? Is it important? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. If one of us goes missing, you know, before Wednesday, we may need to talk to the police about what... You know, the last time we saw the person, they were wearing... Let's just take a picture of you guys that way when the police come by. None of you better be missing in a couple of days, all right? Do we need it all? Is this a summary? Okay. There were a bunch of people in class. Who? I don't know. People. I definitely am pretty sure the prof was here. Can you remember his name? Prof. Doctor. I think. Funny name to give a kid. Probably doesn't matter if you remember my name. Probably matters is that you actually remember how to get to this room. Kind of a biggie. How much information do you need? You just need enough. You need enough in whatever the particular situation is. Which is why it seems that we sometimes remember more or less stuff, depending upon the kinds of conditions that we are experiencing. So, again, costs and benefits. There are costs and benefits with respect to our memory. It may be lovely. And I mean, again, if an engineer were designing a system, you'd remember everything. You would have access to everything that was stored. Your brain would be like a giant computer-based library system that just kept filing each individual little factoid of material with an incredible cataloging system that could go under a tree. Your brain would be Google and Wikipedia and everything else. Your brain would be the internet. Ever thought about how much crap is out there on the internet? Well, there's a lot, okay? You don't necessarily need it all. Matter of fact, if you ever do Google searches for things, it's like, I don't need this. This is not what I'm looking for. Same thing. If your brain really worked that way, you'd probably spend a lot of time pulling up your relevant information. In fact, there are individuals that have been documented who remember basically everything. They are quite dysfunctional. They remember a shopping list from 20 years ago just as well as they remember the material that they have to have for an exam this week. To get access to particular pieces of information, they have to sift through every memory, every fact they've ever had. It is very, very slow and cognitively taxing, not to mention frustrating. Most of us don't exist that way. Here's the trade-off. Speed and ease of recall. Sure, if you lose your keys, it'll be really nice to be able to go back through your memories, you know, like winding the tape backwards, you know, hitting the fast reverse on the machine. Ah, there they are. My wife consistently misplaces the television remote control. I really wish she could do this. She cannot. It is very, very frustrating. For me. Her argument is that she's got these kids around and dogs and everything else. And if I wasn't such a lazy no-good just off teaching, sure, I'm teaching, you know, all the time, then maybe someone will pay attention, blah, 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 blah. But if I get around to actually building that wall entertainment unit where the remotes could go right back in. Anyways, not important, but my point is, we can't find the TV remote. Again, I seem to just keep acquiring TV remotes, and we can't find any of them. That'd be nice. But we don't tend to do that. If you've got all that information, it's not rapid. The processing time takes a while. Slow. There's, if you will, a cognitive lag. And the more cognitive lag you've got, and the more cognitive processing that is devoted to trying to pull up that other piece of information, what are you not focusing on right in the instance? This is probably one of these problems with talking on cell phones in the car. I'm not even going to talk about texting in the car as you're driving. Because how are you working the steering wheel? Oh, that's my knee. It's great. Yeah. But even talking on a cell phone. Well, what if it's hands-free? Doesn't matter. How do we usually talk to people? Think back. Think back to EEA. How would we have talked to people in the past? How far would you have been from somebody? Seriously, kids, this ain't rocket science. How far away could you get to someone 10,000 years ago and have a conversation? Yeah, shouting distance at best. It's a pretty crappy conversation at that point. You have to come here to talk. Yeah, okay, right. Look, that's what we evolved with. We evolved with conversation in close proximity. It's not just our ba-ba-ba-ba-ba words that we're using. For language, we've got the body language, which probably gestural language evolved way before vocal language. You're gabbing away on the cell phone in the car, even if your hands are on the wheel, you're missing a whole series of cognitive cues for that conversation, which means your brain is trying to fill all this in. Okay? You're trying to process it. You're trying to make inferences and construct what the person on the other end of the phone is really meaning. Right? Theory of mind. So we're talking about that. See how this comes in, right? Machiavellian intelligence. What do they really mean? Well, if you don't have that person right there, you can glance at them and see, you're losing that information. Your whole social cognitive part of your brain is going, I'm trying to make guesses now. Is this realistic? Is it possible? Is it feasible? What's going on? Hard to do. The cognitive strain then, in terms of doing that, hey, that's taken away from this other really difficult thing, which is called driving. We didn't evolve to drive, right? We can learn to do it, some people better than others, but it's hard. You're focusing that much of your attention on trying to piece together what actually is happening in the conversation, that's processing that's taken away from this other tricky task of trying to drive. We didn't evolve to go that fast. Fastest people alive can do, like, I don't know, 100 meters in under 10 seconds. 9 seconds or so. For 100 meters! I mean, you know, make them run for a few hundred meters, they're done at that speed. We're not dealing with 100 kilometers an hour. We have a hard time processing this. Okay? Trade-offs. Some sort of balance is going to be it. And the balance will shift. I mean, if you're in a relatively quiet room, no other distractions, talking on the phone, sure. You're probably actually, from a cognitive, social cognition perspective, theory of mind perspective, able to process things better. You can devote your full attention to that. I got kids. Stunningly distracting to have kids around you when you're trying to carry on a conversation with another adult. Try it sometime. You know, if you don't have three kids, go find three kids. Rent them, borrow them someplace, just for a little experiment and distraction. Or just get three of your friends to act like kids and come up and bother you about stuff, which is really important to them. But from their perspective of social cognition, they don't get why you don't want to listen to them right at this precise moment in time. because it's really, really important, especially if they're under three and only really have desire psychology. It's like, I want to tell you this right now. It's like, Daddy's talking right now. Blah, 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 blah. No, you just be quiet. Blah, blah, blah. Costs and benefits. All right, so categorization. What is a way of coping with this? Categorization. Sometimes called stereotyping, sometimes called prototyping, okay? You're parsing the information space. Now, it's a trade-off, again. By using a prototype, or a stereotype, if you prefer, this allows you access to information more rapidly, it's more succinct, but it's non-inclusive. You're generalizing. So, if you will, it's sometimes called the majority rule. So I could make some sort of generalization about you as students. Hardworking, studious, all going to do great on midterm. I hope I'm correct. Time will tell. This is why I don't want to know who, for example, whose papers I am grading when I am grading them, because I know what the past grades were from things. I want to be able to evaluate each assignment and exam and paper in its own right. I don't want to have these past stereotypes. It's like, oh yeah, this student that's done kind of badly on the first three assignments, they're probably not going to do well in the midterm. Right? So you get a bias coming in on that. I don't want that. I want to be as fair as possible. That's why I just have people put their information on, you know, the exam on the front page, just where it's asked for. Never had these things come apart in the past. They're stapled together quite well. Okay, and the assignments, is like put it on the back. So, you know, with the exams, turn the whole stack upside down, and I work from back to front. I do one question at a time so that, you know, again, I'm not going through, you know, here's the five questions and midterms. Oh, they've done really badly on the last four. Fifth one's probably going to be crap, too. No, I do one at a time, so I don't tend to remember. You know, sometimes even reshuffle the pile of exams so that I'm trying to minimize sort of prototyping or categorization there. Bit of a pain for me. Great for you guys, but you know. What this allows us to do, more generally, in terms of memory, by using these sort of stereotypes, it allows us to increase our retrieval speed, makes it easier to do, but it may not be accurate. All right? So inaccuracies can come in as a byproduct of this. You don't have the complete set of information by necessity. Rottweilers, dangerous dogs, right? Stereotype. Rottweilers attack kids, right? And people. Some do. A lot of them don't. More attacks from German Shepherds, actually. And Rottweilers. Collies, actually, like Lassie, actually can attack people a fair amount, too. Dalmatians. Dalmatians bite kids. But the Disney show, they're so great. You know what Dalmatians were bred to do? They were bred to be coach guards. Like coaches, not stagecoaches, but like in Europe, well, stagecoaches too, but, you know, coach pulled by like six horses, be traveling throughout Europe on the roads, highwaymen would jump out, it's like, your money or your life, sort of thing. And these dogs, Dalmatians, were bred to run in between the horses, right? I mean, the horses are galloping along, and these bloody dogs are running between the hooves. And so if someone jumps out, points a gun at you, your money or your, and these dogs come ripping out from between the horse's legs, and it's like, attack them. Have you got the visualization? Okay. Generalization, categorization. Right. I'm sure there's a few Dalmatians that, you know, are great with kids. There are some. They're high strung, high energy, and they were bred to attack people. Disney made some cute movies about them. Okay. So we generalize. Or, I've forgotten the particular breed. It's a Dutch breed of dog. We just used in, they were brought in on the Osama bin Laden takedown, right? A Mala something, I forgot. The Dutch breed, okay? So, the dog was designed actually to kill things. Okay, bred for this. But the real worry that people have is that now that someone's going to go, ooh, I want to get the dog that was in there with the special forces team that killed Osama bin Laden. They're horrible dogs to have as pets. But great dogs if you want to kill somebody. You got to work them constantly. I mean, unless you are an expert in dog training, you want to devote a lot of your time to this. Don't do. But what's the generalization? Cool dog. For some people that want particular, you know, special forces wannabes, get the cool dog. Okay. You get the cool stuff, you forget about all the other stuff. You miss the other stuff. So, why isn't our memory just perfect? Your textbook talks about Schachter's seven sins of memory, things like mistakes and errors and time-based things, okay? So, take a look at those. Transience, absent-mindedness, blocking, if you've learned about one thing and then trying to learn about this, a second thing that really means the same, does the same thing, we have a hard time with that. Misattribution, suggestibility, biases, persistence, all of these, okay? Are these mistakes? From an engineering perspective, you wouldn't really want to develop a computer program that would work this way. You wouldn't want, say, your filing system for tax audits to work like our memory does. But it's doing something very, very different. Right? Blocking. Okay, so in blocking, quickly,
we'll do a little bit of learning theory, of course. This won't be amazing. So we take conditional stimulus one, pair it with an unconditional stimulus. Do that a whole bunch of times. This eventually leads to a conditional response. Then we say, hey, why don't we make a compound CS? So then we do CS2 plus CS1 paired with the US. We do a bunch more trials doing it this way. We find this still leads to a really strong CR. This leads to pretty much nothing. Maybe a weak CR. Why? That's called blocking. Prior learning here blocks the learning about that. If you're an engineer designing or a computer engineer designing a computer program to retrieve information, this is a crappy way of doing it. If you're a biological organism, why do you need to waste time learning about that? You already got that. That tells you that you're going to experience the US. That tells you what conditional response you need to make. This, you don't need it. I mean, sure, if you got an infinite amount of resources, time, budget available for learning, knock yourself out. Most organisms don't. So, you already got something that's a good predictor of the outcome of the US. Why bother learning a second thing? We get this all kinds of times in the real world, right? If you were brought up believing and being taught something about, I don't care, politics, okay? If that's everything you were exposed to, then, you know, you get older, you start getting exposed to other things, but you don't tend to pay attention to those if they're opposite to what you'd already learned. So we get into faulty memory. We have problems with memory. It's not perfect. Let's take a break. Okay? Come on back in 10, and we will continue.